There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine a time meant for family bonding, basking in the warmth of the August sun and enjoying each other's company. Well, in 1982, a family of six was enjoying just that. But for them, what should have been a joyous occasion turned into the ultimate nightmare when a seventh shadow, uninvited and threatening, emerged from the depths of the woods during their camping vacation. This is the chilling tale of a family's disappearance amidst the wilderness of Wells Gray Provincial Park. I'm Nicole.
My name's Ben, and this is Wicked and Grim,
a true crime podcast. Cheers.
Cheers. We're drinking some good wine today.
Mm-hmm.
From, what is it?
Oh. Grey Monk. Are you going to read the label again?
Sure, I will.
This is not sponsored.
Not sponsored by Grey Monk's 2020 Pinot Noir. It's from the BCVQA Okanagan Valley.
It's dang good.
Delicious and nutritious, my friends.
So good. Yes. I was compiling a list. I was like, what do we have to chat about?
What do we have to chat about?
And Ben's like, did you put ice cream on the grocery list?
Yeah. Well,
apparently that is like, you know, right up there.
Yes, it is. You need some motherfucking ice cream.
Actually had some and I ate it. I'm obsessed with ice cream.
Yeah, I know.
Did you look for that and it was gone?
Yes.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
I was well aware. You're obsessed with ice cream and you ate it all. Thanks.
Yeah, it's so good. Okay, so we have some patrons to thank.
We do.
And then we also have I'm doing this case.
Yay!
Wow, Ben gets a break since
I know.
Like, I think the last one I did, dude, was like in December.
Wow.
That's bad. I apologize.
It's been a while since I've been... Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Singing some Creed right now. But instead of singing Creed, I'm going to go ahead and thank the patrons. How's that?
That would be wonderful.
Okay, so we have two amazing people who joined us over on Patreon this week. We have Crystal Burbridge and Ashley Parks. Thank you so much. We appreciate you guys.
Yeah.
It means a lot for joining us over there.
I love that.
If you guys want to join Patreon, links down below. You get behind the scenes. They just helped us name one of our chickens.
They did.
You get exclusive content. It's fantastic. We did a pre-show before this episode, and they're getting that too.
Drop some bombs in there, you know?
Exactly. Dropping some good heads-up information. We just dropped a couple big ones in there,
We did.
So.
Okay. So should we just dive right in? I'm like antsy-pantsy
sure.
now.
Sure. I guess you're running the show. You got the episode.
I know. I haven't, you know, I'm going to be rusty. I might be a bit rusty, but I also know this freaking case like the back of my hand.
That's good. That's good.
So
I feel like I'm like the jury right now. I'm just watching the prosecutor taking the floor, addressing the courtroom. And I'm just like, okay, what's going on?
I know we've switched roles. It's a bit,
I like it.
A bit weird.
I like it.
I'll be nice. I will be nice. This is a two-parter. But I'm pretty sure that I said earlier in another episode that the next case I do is most likely going to be a two-parter. So.
Well, you had read a book for this, watched multiple documentaries, not to mention articles in and out and through and through. So.
Yeah. I was going to squeeze it all into one and I was like, you know what? No.
Sometimes it's nice to do those deep dives.
Yeah. And I want to spend a smidge more time on part two. So, you know, it allows for that.
Respectable. Respectable.
Okay. Okay. So let's go here.
Let's go.
You ready for this? You haven't been asked that sort of question for a while.
No, I haven't. Kind of caught me off guard, if I'm honest.
Okay.
But yes, I am. Go for it. Do it.
Okay. It was to be a glorious 2-week camping vacation in Wells Gray Provincial Park. This is one of British Columbia's largest and most rugged recreational areas. It's in our province, which is very exciting. I just have to throw that out there. The park itself covers just over 5,400 square kilometers or 1.3 million acres, and has something to offer for almost every outdoor enthusiast. It's a place we need to visit.
Sounds amazing.
So Bob Johnson, his wife Jackie, who he'd been married to for 21 years, and their two daughters, they had a daughter named Janet, who was 13, and a daughter named Karen, who was 11, they left their home on August 2nd, 1982, with the intention of meeting up with Jackie's retired parents, George and Edith Bentley. The Bentleys, who were both in their late 60s, were avid campers and had actually recently just purchased a new truck and camper for their adventures.
Okay.
So, you know, living that retired life, like that is the dream, I think.
The dream that we all dream of, you know?
Yeah.
Just having that freedom.
Getting yourself some new toys, spending time with your kids, your family, you know?
Getting drunk out in the provincial park with your new truck and camper when you're chilling by the lake and water.
That's Ben's idea, I guess, eh, of retirement?
Phenomenal.
I feel like you do that now.
I do that at home. If I were to be retired, I could do it out of the home.
There you go.
Yeah. And then I would do it in a home. See the progression of how this works, right?
Yeah. Okay, so for the trip, they had also secured a 10-foot aluminum boat that they fastened on the top of the camper. It was going to be a good time. They were a close-knit family, three generations of compatible, loving individuals who wanted to enjoy the outdoors and just spend time together. So 2 weeks came and went, with the Johnson family set to return home to West Kelowna on August 16th. But Bob didn't report for work as expected. And in 20 years, he had never missed a day's work.
Oh, dang. That's dedication.
Yes. He was a very, very good employee. He even had a workplace injury where he lost a finger. And he returned to work the very next day.
Damn.
So to say that this, you know, him missing a, you know, time at work without any contact, like, it was very much so out of character.
No kidding. Their employer must have thrown him a damn good pizza party for losing a finger.
You'd hope, eh?
One would hope. It would better be more than a pizza party, but in today's age, and yeah, it's probably just a pizza party.
I can't remember what the company was, but it was like he was a sawer. So it would have been like a mill.
Sawer? Like a saw filer? Or?
I think it just said sawer. Is that a
sawer?
I don't know. He worked in a mill of sorts.
A mill? So. Okay. Well, I can relate.
You can lose fingers in that sort of environment pretty easily, can't you?
I've seen many, because I worked in sawmills for over 15 years. Yeah. I've seen countless people missing digits as a result of working in sawmills.
Yeah, that is, I couldn't imagine. And I would be one of those people that'd be like, I can't go to work for a really long time.
I remember when I secured a job at one of the sawmills during the interview, they were asking questions and everything. Then I got the position. They hired me on the spot there. And then I went to shake everyone's hand. And one of the guys interviewing me, he was missing all the fingers on his hand.
Wow.
Up to his first knuckle.
Really?
Yeah.
Did that make you kind of be like, uh-oh, what did I just do?
No, because I had already been in malls for like 5 years.
Right.
It was the second one I went to.
Okay.
So I was already well aware of people missing fingers and stuff. It was just every finger on the same hand was gone. I was like, wow.
Gosh, that would have been brutal.
Yeah.
Okay. So on August 23rd, after missing work, so he missed work for an additional week, Bob's boss filed a missing persons complaint to the RCMP. You know, he was like a well-liked guy. They were probably just giving him the benefit of the doubt or something, right? Yeah. But eventually they're like, enough's enough. The report was passed on to Sergeant Frank Baruta of Clearwater Detachment, who went about making several local inquiries, but unfortunately, he came back empty-handed. The families were then put in the system as missing persons. It was August 6th that was actually the last time anyone had been in contact with any of the family members. Edith had contacted their other daughter, Sharon, from the Chamber of Commerce telephone in Clearwater, BC, to check in. She let her know that they were having a great time camping and would be going to meet the Johnsons in Wells Gray Provincial Park. Little did anyone think this would be the last time they'd hear from either family.
Dang.
Brian Bentley, so that's George and Edith's other son. They had three children in total. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Linda, who I imagine were worried friggin' sick, they circulated their family's photos in the area between Clearwater and Belmont. Among some of the first reports to come in was one from a gas station attendant east of Clearwater recalling seeing George and Jackie and the two children while they were filling up their car with gas. George had asked if they knew of any good areas to do berry picking in the area. It was promising lead because it showed that both families did in fact make it to the area of Wells Gray Provincial Park, and this led to a massive search of that area.
Well, that's a massive provincial park, though. That's going to be a major key factor here in this part, in this case.
But at least they knew that they arrived to the destination, which... Yeah,
that's definitely a good thing. Yeah, I don't know if you know, but do you know where in the park they were supposed to have been? Like, were they supposed to be at a specific lake or campsite?
No, I don't even think that was... Something I had read, they kind of like to camp in... like more rugged, kind of off the beaten path places.
Gotcha.
So that for this investigation is not helpful whatsoever.
And this is in the early 80s.
Yeah.
So there's not a whole lot of provincial campsites that are going to be like paved roads, well-maintained, a lot of traffic. Yeah.
So.
Wow.
The search was jointly led by Baruta, who I mentioned earlier, and a staff sergeant, Norm Schaefer, who was from Kamloops. The focus was on the park and involved police, parks personnel, private citizens clubs, and local pilots. The park was searched tirelessly for any sign of the missing families, but they had no such luck and no clues were found. At this point, both Janet and Karen had missed the start of the school year and all the excitement that goes along with that. It wasn't until September 13th that an individual who was out picking mushrooms during the last week of August contacted the police, believing that he had seen the Johnsons' vehicle. He reported that he'd been in the Battle Mountain Road area, which is within the Wells Gray Provincial Park, mm-hmm. where he came across a burnt-out Chrysler similar to the one belonging to the Johnson family. So once Baruta got word of this, he and Constable Mike Glass drove to the area to investigate. At the location that was described, they noticed what appeared to be tire tracks angling off into the bush. And barely visible from the road lay the wreckage of a car, its outline cast in a dull orange hue. Despite the difficulty in spotting it, they pressed on, drawing nearer to the wreck, which was about 150 feet from the road. It's worth noting that this road was typically traveled only by horseback or like 4x4 vehicles.
Okay.
Confirming that they were far from the usual paths within the park.
Yeah. So they're definitely going off the beaten path. Assuming they are driving their own vehicle in this area, they're definitely going down places people don't generally go.
Exactly.
Trying to find that good spot, you know?
Yeah. So upon closer inspection, they confirmed that the license plate was in fact a match. Surrounding the vehicle was scorched earth. Nothing remained untouched by the flames. Everything had been melted or warped beyond recognition. So they approached cautiously to take a peek inside the car. And when they did, the two froze in their tracks.
Bodies.
It was at this moment that the nature of the investigation shifted dramatically. What had initially seemed like, you know, could have been possibly an accident, now demanded a thorough homicide investigation, and the area needed to be secured immediately.
So bodies.
Well,
Jesus, just say it.
Gosh.
I'm just like, come on. Like,
What is it? So this is when Sergeant Michael Eastham got called, who would lead the investigating RCMP officers. And he only gets called when there's bodies.
Yes, there we go. Thank you. Bodies.
He also wrote the book I read on this case, along with Ian McLeod, and it's titled The Seventh Shadow. So upon his arrival, Eastham went straight to work, examining the burned out vehicle, and inside, among the melted glass and metal, was a horrible mess. The back seat of the car was filled with burned skeletal remains. The bodies had been literally cremated.
Wow.
Yes. It initially appeared to be two bodies, but a coroner on site was later able to determine he believed there was actually four bodies. It was absolutely shocking that what remained in the car's back seat amounted to four human adult bodies, with one of the skulls appearing to have a bullet hole.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
So there was how many individuals in this family? The two grandparents, two parents.
Two parents and two kids.
So we have four adult
four
bodies.
Four adults. Yeah.
Okay.
And I am going to, because you kind of mentioned earlier, this is not, like, this is not where they were camping.
Okay.
This vehicle was not found where they were camping.
Okay.
So when approaching the car, it's interesting because the investigator, Eastham, he noticed that there was five keys dangling from the lock of the trunk of the car. And he, like, wondered, you know, what the fuck is in there?
Yeah.
And realize, like, you know, I'm the one that's going to have to look in this trunk.
I had a feeling when I realized the two kids were missing.
Yeah. So it was now time to investigate why keys were dangling from the trunk of the car. And they couldn't just open the trunk. I mean, this vehicle was just, like, not in a good state.
Seized up and burned.
Yeah. So they had to use a pry bar to open it. And they got a shock of their life. They had hoped the trunk was, you know, maybe used to store the fuel and some sort of accelerant to make the fire burn so intensely. But instead, staring up at them were two little skulls, one of them looking straight at them.
Damn.
Yeah.
Damn.
Two vibrant young girls that were about Eastham's daughter's age, too, which would make it just that much worse.
That would have hit him right in the gut.
Yeah. I just, oh man, it almost, like, I know so much about the case, but even just reading it, it makes me feel just so sad, like, so sad. So.
Well, I can't blame you. It's not like that's an easy piece of information to really digest for anyone.
Yeah.
Let alone Eastham staring the skull down.
Yeah. So the whole atmosphere obviously changed once the trunk was opened and the reality of the situation hit. One of the little skulls had a prominent hole over the left eye, looking like she had been shot in the back of the head, and this was the exit wound. They could only think what kind of sick, deluded coward would take a child's life.
No shit.
You know, two children's life.
And then four adults too.
Yeah. The whole family. Three generations.
Yeah. Wow.
Tracking dogs, helicopters, and all the manpower the RCMP could muster were employed in search for more evidence, including the Bentley's truck and camper, which were not at this site. What was discovered next was what the investigators felt was the murder site. A report from a park employee had come in who recalled seeing a truck and camper unit parked at the old Bear Creek prison site, which was still within the park. This was approximately 20 kilometers from where the burned out Johnson car was found. Here, they located six 22 caliber shell casings and some beer caps of the brand known to be enjoyed by Bob Johnson. Full bottles of the same beer were also discovered cooling in the nearby creek.
Ah, shit.
Which I just, like, kind of love that he was using the creek to cool his beer, but it's also like, oh man, you know?
Yeah.
It seemed just so innocent. Like, it's so innocent that they were just there chilling with family and on vacation. And yeah. Also found were two sticks with sharp edges thought to be used by Janet and Karen for roasting marshmallows.
Oh, fuck me.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had the Johnsons' vehicle and now the murder site, but they still needed to find more information. Yet to be found was the Bentley's truck and camper and a suspect. Over the next year, investigators pulled out all the stops to continue the search of what happened to these families. Researching this case, I honestly felt like the investigators team, they actually did a, like, not all cases, it seems like, you know, shit goes astray or whatever, but they did a really good job of investigating this.
I feel like we've covered a few cases recently where they've pulled out all the stops. They didn't let go.
Didn't give up.
And they pushed through and eventually they had results because of it. Mm-hmm. And so shout out to any authority figures, investigators, RCMP, police, whoever. Shout out to you guys out there who are the ones who are doing that, because that's what these victims need, is someone like you to find who the fuck did this and give them a voice.
Totally. Well, because I imagine, like I just said, this has been going on for a whole year and you would kind of lose hope in at some point, right? But it's like, it's almost like they don't, and they just keep powering through, which is awesome.
It is.
So a massive aerial and ground search of the park was done.
Surf and turf? Sorry, it was a joke. But it was water and land, not Aaron, but my bad. Sorry. It was a terrible, terrible joke that honestly didn't even really line up, but I just still said it anyways.
I was even like, how do I respond to this? Because it makes no sense.
The thought process was there. Give me that.
It was there. It was there. Yeah. You're rusty at just, you know, sitting back and
looking. I am. Right? I'm sorry. Maybe I need to drink more. I don't know.
They even went about constructing a nearly exact duplicate of the Bentley's truck and camper unit.
Okay.
No detail was spared. Like they found pretty well the exact truck, the exact camper. Even an aluminum boat was placed on top of the camper. I think they had a motor at the back too of the camper, like a boat motor. So that was placed, and they had it driven across the country in hopes that somebody would remember a similar vehicle and call in with a tip.
Dang. Wow. Yes. That's thorough and in depth.
Yes. There were a couple little Easter eggs though, because they were getting so many calls. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that Eastman said, that he really likes being able to use, you know, people to help with these sort of cases. And so there was two things in there that they altered just to see if witnesses, you know, pointed those out or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So they're specifically changing things to see if people notice.
Yeah.
Which would point to if they're being falsified information or whatever.
Totally.
Love that idea.
Like, that's just smart, hey?
It's really smart.
Thinking outside the box.
It is.
So there was more behind the reasoning to this. The police had received numerous sightings of a camper fitting the description of the Bentleys, driven by two French-speaking males. The sightings indicated that the unit was heading east, and because the occupants spoke French, it was assumed the men were making their way to Quebec.
Okay, yeah.
They even got a call from an auto body mechanic in Windsor, Ontario, who saw the bulletins and contacted the police, stating that a few months earlier, two French-speaking males operating a vehicle identical to the missing Bentley truck approached him asking for a midnight paint job.
Oh, shit. Okay, that's sus as fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we just, you know, can you just, in the middle of the night, just paint this truck?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Do you know if he approached the guy in the middle of the night, or were they like, hey, at midnight tonight, can you paint the truck?
I'm not certain, but I know he didn't do it. He sent them somewhere else.
Either way, that's suspect as fuck for sure.
because they were also asking how to dispose of a weapon, like a gun that's a 22 caliber.
Oh, just so happens to be the same caliber.
Yeah. Well,
I mean,
that is common one, isn't it?
22 is very common, especially in any area where you're hunting. 22 caliber rifles are used for small game, rabbit, grouse, et cetera.
Right? Yeah.
They're common. Any hunter growing up used a 22 caliber. They probably have one laying around. But why are you going to just approach some auto body shop and be like, hey, can you paint my truck at midnight? Also, do you know how to get rid of a gun?
Well, I think so. He was a little bit on the sketchy side himself, as far as it seemed.
Was he, though? Because he turned these guys away and reported them to the police.
He did.
Maybe he was just rough around the edges.
I don't know. So the witness was able to describe details too about the truck and camper that had never even been released.
Really?
Which is so bizarre because unfortunately in the end, this proved to be false.
Really?
And the investigators, they heard some backlash from this endeavor of them, you know, like going across the country and stuff. But they were just following leads and they had tons of leads. That had spotted this. So I guess it was just like two French speaking, also sketchy people that had a very similar.
Wow.
Unit. I don't know.
Suspiciously wanted to dispose of a 22 caliber gun and get it painted at midnight.
What did these two people do? You know,
no kidding. Or here's a theory. What if these guys are driving the same looking vehicle, happen to have a 22 caliber rifle that, you know, they were hunting with earlier in the season or something like that, or whatever. And they are now seeing these news bulletins and stuff. And it's like searching for these guys who stole this truck.
And they're like, holy shit, did we do something?
They're like, we didn't do anything, man. We got to get rid of this gun and change our truck because we didn't do shit, man. Like, what if they're panicking?
I know, because I mean, people are going to have similar trucks and similar campers in like a country, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, even me, like I have a very distinctive looking truck. It is bright fucking orange.
Yeah.
But there's like three other trucks that are damn near identical to mine in town.
Yeah, I know. And like I'll pass them and I have to do a double take. So.
Yeah. I get told that a lot from friends. They're like, oh, you know, I waved at you driving by this area.
And you were an asshole and you didn't wave back.
I'm like, I was at home all day yesterday. What are you talking about? That wasn't me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there you go.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
That's okay. So, like I said, they were getting some backlash from this endeavor, but they were just following the leads. And they themselves said, can you really put a price tag on the lives of six individuals? They were going to solve this case no matter what it took.
Yeah. No props to them. I'm fully supporting them in their decision to do that.
Yeah. And it wasn't just a few reports. It was many. So, I mean, like maybe if it was just one or two, they might not have, but it was like a lot.
Yeah.
And I mean, it did keep the mass murder in the public eye, which was a good thing. In total, the police received 13,000 tips regarding this case.
What?
Like it was, I mean, the manpower that they would also have for that, have to deal with that kind of amount of tips.
How do you sort through 13,000? How do you categorize and process that?
I don't even
Holy,
know.
Holy wow.
So, but I mean, like he never made it seem like that was bad or anything. Like that's what he wanted. He wanted,
of course,
you know, the help of the public and stuff. That's how he usually went about kind of solving his cases.
Yeah. No, I assumed he was happy to have it. It's just, but still, that's a lot to do. That's a lot of work.
Well, yeah. And it's people just genuinely wanting to help. I mean, there's probably the odd one that isn't, but yeah, that is overwhelming. It's overwhelming.
That's a lot.
So now on October 18th, 1983, this is about 14 months after the Johnsons and Bentleys disappeared, Eastham got a call from Sergeant Frank Baruta in Clearwater stating that he had two forestry workers with him saying they found the burned remains of the Bentley truck and camper on Trophy Mountain.
Okay.
This was only 20 kilometers from the murder site and about 30 kilometers from where the Johnson's car was located. Eastham, he couldn't believe it. They had spent so much time searching the area, like so much. They had, you know, aerial searches, like ground searches. They spent a lot of time searching this spot.
Well, to play devil's advocate, in British Columbia, when you're looking at the boreal forest, if you're in the air, you can't see the ground.
Yeah, it's so dense.
It's so dense. And when you're on the ground, you can barely see 20 yards in front of you. If you're lucky, it's, again, so dense. Mm-hmm. Not only dense, the topographical, the up, the down, the left, the right, it's insane. You can't imagine it unless you've experienced it.
Yeah, it is next level. But there was also another reason. So upon his arrival back to Wells Gray Provincial Park, it did make sense because the truck, like I said, it was also burned. It was the exact same color of the earth that it like was surrounding it. It looked like it had been there for 50 years rusting away.
I also like how you just let me go off on that rant about like the boreal forest is so thick and you're like, yep. Also, there's another reason. Thanks.
Well, I think that's so a reason.
Oh yeah.
Because it being like in our forest, if you're up in, you know, a plane, like you can't really see through the trees that way.
No, you can't. So and, like to have something that's going to look like it's been there for 50 years, at first glance, it's probably just going to look like an upturned stump or pile of dirt.
Yeah. And something too that just came back to me, there had been a forest fire or something in that area not long ago. So like that would just blend right in as well.
No kidding. Right? There's going to be a bunch of scorched stumps and trees and stuff. Yeah. 'Cause that lasts a long time. That leaves a mark for years.
So this was also very high up the mountain. Eastham thought that he was going, in his book, he mentioned like he's going to get a fucking nosebleed from being so high up this mountain from the altitude.
Jeez.
So like it was, I mean, it makes sense that it wasn't found you think about it. It was pretty obvious that whoever drove the truck all the way up to the spot had been a local with knowledge of the area though.
Definitely.
Had the truck not high centered on a log, it would have been driven off a huge cannon at the end of the trail and
Canyon.
What did I say? Cannon?
Cannon. It would have driven off a huge cannon.
Canyon. Sorry. I was getting real into it.
And getting tongue-tied. Sorry.
So it would have been driven off of there. And if it did, it would never, ever have been found again.
Yeah.
So he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, neither would have the person driving it. They never would have been found either.
Well, unless they could have just like put something on the gas pedal and let it go off the cliff.
Which probably would have been a better idea than what he did, clearly, because it would have never have been found. And that probably would have played to his benefit.
Yeah, but he got stuck.
Oh, he got stuck.
Yeah, it was high centered on a log.
Oh, I thought you said okay, sorry. I see what you said now. But I thought you were saying because he had knowledge, he did not get high center on any logs and made his way up this trail where he didn't even fall off into a canyon.
Okay, no. He did get high centered. And for that, I mean, they were able to find this eventually.
I see. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that could have been my bad too. I was like getting too excited here.
I got threw off with the cannon. I'm like, where's the cannon?
Oh my God. Okay, so their focus was once again brought back to the Clearwater area. And within weeks, investigators had several leads that pointed to a local man. And his name was David Shearing. One informant called in after hearing a rumor that Shearing had run over a person out on the Wells Gray Park Highway a couple years back. And he actually got away with it.
Wow.
Oddly enough, the same day that call came in, one of the investigators was having lunch downtown when a waitress slid him a piece of paper with Shearing's name written on it. You know, I was like, this is a sketchy guy. Like, maybe look into him.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
And then the next day during a door-to-door, that was another thing they did. They went door-to-door. Like, they had tons of people going and visiting everyone.
Like Girl Scouts?
Pretty well.
Selling cookies sort of situation.
But it wasn't selling cookies.
Yeah.
So Shearing's name came up once again when a woman said to her husband, aren't you going to tell them about what Dave Shearing said about re-registering that truck with the bullet hole in the door? Just like yells this to her husband who's at the door with like a police officer. And then he just like side-eyes her. And is like, the fuck, you know?
Yeah, because clearly he was going to keep it hush-hush.
Yeah. But thankfully...
I could just picture it. Hey, Phil! Phil! Ain't you going to tell him about that bullet hole truck he was going to re-register? Shut up, Debbie.
I know, like it is, you can literally picture it.
Oh, I can 100% picture it.
But thankfully, that officer just like kept cool. Like he didn't hear that.
Yeah, he pretended like he didn't hear it.
Right? Like it was just like not going to register with him.
Yeah.
So that, you know, this guy wouldn't like alert Dave Shearing or whatever. So David Shearing, who lived a couple miles from the alleged murder scene at the time of the murders, was 23 years old.
Oh, dang, he's young.
Yes. Despite his unpleasant reputation and criminal record, David came from a respectable family, unlike many of the backgrounds of individuals we often cover.
Yeah.
His father, who passed away only about 4 months before the murders, had once been a prison guard and his brother a sheriff. He had previously been arrested for assault, drinking and driving, and drug possession. Up until his recent move to Tumbler Ridge for work, David had lived in the area all of his life and would have been very familiar with the park and roads, back roads or whatever.
Yeah.
And something I did have this in here, but it's not anymore. He like had actually graduated from high school and everything and even had like a little bit of post-secondary education, I believe in like mechanics or something.
Okay. Which honestly at that time is like, it's pretty rare.
So, like, I mean, his background was nothing to, like, really be alarmed about or, like, oh, you know, that kind of makes sense, I guess, or whatever.
He's not out torturing animals or something like that.
Yeah. So, this was now November 16th, and Isham got on the phone with Constable Ron German, who he had previously worked with and who he knew was currently in, like, working in Tumbler Ridge as an officer. And just for reference, Tumbler Ridge is about 10-hour or so drive from Clearwater. So it wasn't like they could just hastily drive them there themselves, right?
They also have dinosaur footprints in Tumbler Ridge.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been there. I've seen them. You can go there and they ask you not to touch them because, I mean, it could erode and damage over time, right?
Totally.
But you can like literally like have your hand like in a dinosaur footprint in the ground just off the side of the road. It's pretty cool.
I haven't been. I would really like to one day.
Well, you should.
I should. Okay, so this is how their conversation went.
Sorry, that was just an interesting
It was conversation. Very interesting.
We just had. Go ahead, though.
So he goes, Ron, it's Mike Eastam here. Mike, Ron beamed, I guess you're pretty busy with that family murder case. Look, I've got a bit of a weird duck up here. He said he used to live in Clearwater, and I figured I could ask him some questions if he wanted me to. His name's David William Shearing. Eastham's heart skipped a beat because he hadn't even fucking said the name of the guy yet.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Ron, we're looking at him right now as a possible suspect. Shearing was continuing to get in trouble in Tumbler Ridge and actually had an upcoming court date on the Monday for possession of stolen property or something charge.
Okay.
German said he'd continue to keep an eye on Shearing until they arrived to conduct an interview. And that's where we're stopping
part one. Of course.
I know it is such a dick spot to stop. So I'm so sorry.
I honestly almost forgot that it was going to be a two-part thing. I was just like, we're getting through this. And
yeah, there is a lot more to this story.
Okay.
So that's part one.
You done did just do that to us, didn't you?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Now we have to wait a whole week for part two. Thanks. Appreciate that.
I know. I was there. I was like, okay, I'm going to stop it there, but I am going to get in some shit for stopping it there. But that is just the natural spot to stop. So I do apologize, but I don't apologize. Sorry, not sorry.
Hashtag sorry, not sorry. Wow. Okay. David sounds like a douchebag though. 100%.
Yeah, you guys are definitely going to want to tune into part two because it is a fucking roller coaster.
Yeah, up and down, left and right, and twisting around and upside down.
Just all down, to be honest.
Just all down. Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah. I see what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in for it.
So there you go.
Okay. Well, that's you caught my attention.
You're going to be able to to wait a week.
I might have to read this book in the meantime. Just catch up in the middle. What was the book called again?
One day I'm just going to like be trying to find my book and you'll have it.
Yeah. I'll just be curled up in the couch.
Oh man, I had it in
seventh
here.
Something, didn't you say?
The Seventh Shadow.
The Seventh Shadow. Okay.
Yeah. The Seventh Shadow.
Okay. I might want to read that after this case. Or before part two. I don't know. We'll find out.
It is very good. There is a lot in it about, him just being an investigator and, you know, like referencing other little cases or his life or whatever.
His experience and point of view.
Yeah, because he's been an investigator for a long time. He's now retired, but which I think is why he can write this book, because he's not like an active, still in the force. But yeah, it is the first half. It was harder to get through, but I always find books sometimes are hard to get started in. But then, halfway through or whatever, I was like, okay. I think that's when I read the half in one day or one evening or whatever, because I was like, okay, yeah, like I'm at the point I can't put this down. So
I understand what you say, though, with the book like being hard to start. It's the same with books, with TV shows, with movies, you name it, because you're not invested in the story or the characters or whoever yet.
Yeah.
And once you get past that point of investment in it, in the story of what's being told or what's happening, then it's okay. You know, I want to see how this person reacts or how this develops. And oh my God, like David actually was also on this other guy's list. Like if I were to just start a conversation, yeah, this guy who potentially murdered people, because I don't know if he actually did or not. He was found in Tumbler Ridge by some other cops for theft of property. Cool. No one's going to care. Mm-hmm. But if we tell them all the stuff you just told us, then you stop for fucking part two. They're going to be pissed because they're invested.
Yeah.
And they're going to want to hear it now. If they can't. They have to wait till next
week. They're going to be pissed because they're invested. Wow. Just throw me under the bus a little more. Why don't you?
Oh, I can. I can keep going. Trust me.
Anyway, I've said this numerous times. There is not many things in life where we have to wait anymore. Where you're like binge watchers, whatever, right? And it's like, that's good. It's good sometimes to have to go a week and anticipate something exciting in your life to, come back next week and be like, oh man, yeah, it's part two and I get to know what happened.
You know, there's some people out there, and I'm not throwing them under the bus. You do you. I do not judge it whatsoever. I'm just giving you another perspective here. There's some people out there who, when they see that we are putting out a part one, they wait until part two is out to listen to them both back to back.
Yeah.
I can totally relate to that, though, because they don't have like the will to like, I got to wait a whole week now. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they could if they wanted to, but like who wants to?
Yeah, I know. It is hard. It's hard. And this story sucks. Like it's super sad. It's super shitty. It just sucks. And yeah, it doesn't get any better, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Well, like you said, it's just downhill.
Yeah.
A roller coaster that just goes down. So, yeah, thanks. Good job so far, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, good job. Good job. I'm liking it. I'm loving it. I can't wait for part two. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And until then, if you guys want to check out more of our social links like Patreon or Instagram or Facebook or YouTube, we have two YouTube channels, one where we vlog and do some lifestyle tiny home stuff, and another one where you can actually watch the recordings of the podcast in visual form. On camera, you can go do that too.
That's Ben doing his hand gesture.
Every time I talk about the camera rolling in us, like you can watch it, I always do the hand gesture because it just feels right.
Yeah.
Feels right.
Natural.
Natural.
Okay. So until next week.
I wasn't even done doing my spiel. You can check all those things in the description of this podcast down below. Go ahead. Click on things. Thanks for listening. Now go ahead.
Are you done, Chatty Cathy?
Sorry. I had a glass of wine. And I want another. And I want to listen to part two.
Well, until part two.
Until part two.
Stay wicked.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.